Welcome to the Anthrozoology Podcast. We're on episode 22. Today, we're continuing our discussion of power words, which are terms that humans use to control the narratives of other than human lives. Today's term is feral, and it's a contentious term in our opinion. Our paper on this topic, Uncivilized Behaviors, was published last year in Society and Animals Journal, and today we'll unpack that paper in a discussion with our special guest and co-author, Debbie Busby. Welcome, Debbie.
So, yeah, hi. I'm really pleased to be kind of, you know, back in the fold of those of us who wrote the paper. I'm a lot further through my PhD now. So as well as being an equine behaviour consultant, helping owners resolve problem behaviours with their horses and supervising other consultants, I'm doing a PhD in qualitative methods, exploring the idea of what is a good life for horses in the contexts of sustainability and particularly social license to operate, which is, even since I started my PhD, has become a lot higher up on the agenda of mainstream equestrian organisations such as the FEI. So I'm at the data collection stage of my PhD now after the literature review and had my methodology and my ethics approved. So that's what I'm up to at the moment.
Hi, I'm Chris. So my PhD looked at cat-human relations and discourses surrounding roaming cats. And I'm actually in the final stages now, hoping to submit next month. Yay. But going back to feral, so sometimes I share my PhD proposal to people that want to get an idea of sort of what it entails to apply for a PhD. And I look at it and I cringe because it's feral. And I want to go through with a red pen and like cross out feral, because we don't like that word anymore. And feral has sort of continued on since the paper and our original discussions to play a part in my PhD.
And I'm Michelle. I did my PhD on elephant-human relationships in Nepal and on elephant and human health and welfare with the co-working relationship between mahouts and captive working elephants. Our third co-host, Sarah, sends her apologies. She could not join us today, but you will see her again on our next episode. Back to you, Chris.
Yeah, so should we start with a dictionary definition of feral? So according to the Webster Dictionary, feral has three meanings. One, a relating to or suggestive of a wild beast. Two, not domesticated or cultivated, wild and free, having escaped from domestication and become wild. And it's actually derived from the medieval Latin feralis, from the Latin fera, meaning wild animal. But what does feral mean?
Well, I think it's interesting because in those definitions, they actually seem to equate feral to wild, which is not how we use it in conversation. We usually equate feral with having escaped domestication, whereas we equate wild with never having been domesticated.
So it's interesting. I posed a question to various cat appreciation groups on Facebook, and the question was, what does feral mean to you? And the data is written up as part of my PhD thesis. And it's super interesting. Most of them were one word answers. And out of 770 responses, 35% said wild, either wild by itself or wild paired with untamed, homeless, unsocialized, not domesticated. And again, domesticated, this that seemed to be defined either as meaning not house trained or as in domesticated, as in biologically domesticated. To a lot of cat people, it means wild, but what does wild mean? And that seems to be more wild-like than actual wild. So yeah, all these different ideas about feral.
I was thinking when you read out those definitions, and something I've talked about a lot as well, is that as well as defining feral, we need to then, in conjunction with that, look at what our definitions of domesticated are and how they apply to how different species became domesticated. So I think it would be interesting. And as you said there, Chris, so you have two different types of understandings and meaning makings of domesticated amongst the people that you asked. I think it would be really interesting to drill down into the understandings of domestication and domesticated as it applies to, you know, a variety of species, such as the ones that we touched on in the paper.
Yeah, one thing that I actually didn't realize until we started discussing the paper was horses, are they domesticated?
Well, yeah, really good question. And it's interesting. I refer to the horses that I work with that are owned owned or, you know, under the care of a guardian or a caregiver. And I refer to them as captive managed because, and to me, domestication is a thin veneer in terms of horses. They weren't domesticated in the same way that cats or dogs were. And the first time that they interacted with humans was when they were hunted and killed for meat. And it was after that that when corralling and that type of farming became more prevalent, that it was possible then to fence them in and then start to utilize their milk or even keep them in a holding situation before they were killed for meat. And it was later on that they started to be used for as draft animals, pulling vehicles and then being ridden. So their domestication did not involve, at first, it didn't involve any kind of co-created relationship in the same way that dogs did, for example, hanging around the campfires or the on looking for food in rubbish heaps and that sort of thing. It was only later in the domestication process, if you want to call it the domestication process, that any type of relational activity became involved in terms of humans, such as just by differences in temperament, certain horses were seen to be more kind of tractable or trainable. And then when enclosed breeding started, then it was possible to form relationships with younger horses that then developed into those animals being able to be more easily trained. So it's, still a question that I like to ask and pose in terms of, are horses domesticated? But in terms of captive managed, this term that I've started to use, captive managed, in terms of what we're talking about, wild versus feral versus domesticated, not totally comfortable with the captive element of it. For sure, they are managed. If we turned the captive managed horses loose, how would they cope in whatever, how would different breeds cope in whatever environment they were turned loose in? So a phrase that I saw recently in terms of a recent bill that's been drafted in UK law is to call them a kept animal. So to term them as a kept animal, which I think is an interesting development in terms of how we look at our relationships, human-animal relationships in general. So
yeah, I think that's interesting thinking about cats too. So There is some discussion about whether cats are fully domesticated or not, because many cats can and do thrive with no human intervention. Mm. But when we start to think about pedigree cats, and that's and me and Sarah talk about this a lot, that they often experience more discomfort, or they really can't survive on the streets because they need regular grooming, because they've been bred for long coats that need managing, or the brachiophilus traits that make it hard for them to survive in sort of dry, that basically they need to be they're more dependent on humans. So it's almost like the pedigree, or these sort of pedigree traits are being selected for to make cats that really are completely domesticated. And I guess the same would be true with horses, because if you a thoroughbred on Dartmoor may not survive as well as Dartmoor pony.
So there came a point where almost like a kind of crossover point where selective breeding then started to have a clear effect in terms of the survivability of particular breeds in particular environments. And of course, initially the selective breeding was to meet the requirements of that environment, but the way that breeds now have moved around the world means that there are thin-skinned breeds kept in cold, damp climates such as the UK, and even what you were saying there about the condition of the cats that live without an owner. I'm in Turkey at the moment, and I see that in the dogs that live as what you would call village dogs or street dogs or community dogs. And for sure, they don't have an owner, but their health is improved, or is sometimes or often improved or maintained by interaction with humans. So Turkey has a trap, neuter and return policy, which influences the numbers that are produced generation on generation. And then in lots of areas, there are groups of human individuals who take care of those groups of dogs in terms of feeding them when their normal food sources or their kind of free roaming food sources dry up, and also make sure that they are dealt with in terms of parasite care and parasite care, worms and fleas mainly. And Turkey has a policy. Turkey has certainly a specific animal welfare policy and legislation, and everywhere you go, you will see certainly supplies of water for the streets and community animals that are at the roadside or outside shops or restaurants. And you see, you'll see dogs wandering in and out of shops and just being allowed to go to sleep, curl up and go to sleep in the corner of a shop, which is different from how dogs are perceived and treated in the UK. And there is a degree of care there in the direction from the human to the dog in providing shelter, food, parasite control.
As I say, it's interesting because that's the same thing that I see in Nepal with the dogs, right? There's a very active, what used to be called street dogs, and what I like to use the term free living dogs, because there's not that expectation that dogs need to be in people's houses. It's actually still a very new concept that dogs, are owned by an individual in Nepal, and it is expanding, but very much that sort of free living animal. And I think that it's, if I were a dog, what would I like? Would I like to be, on the street with my friends, or would I like to be, picked up, taken to a shelter, put in a cage, and then adopted to a single person? Well, the outside, the end product is wonderful, being with a family, but that in-between product is really, traumatic and scary. And whereas here in the US, I feel like we have that that need to, oh my gosh, we can't see a dog on the street. As soon as we see a dog, we need to bring that dog in and, you know, get him to a shelter and get him adopted out. So it's a very different policy.
Yes, it is. And even, you know, even the living with the family, I mean, that's where I do equine behavior consultations, but I also do canine behavior consultations as well in the UK. And in Turkey, when I look at the free living dogs on the wherever they are, I do not see the behavior problems in Turkey that I get called out for in the UK. And I think people don't understand or appreciate how difficult it is to cope as a dog in the UK or a typical kind of UK or a US environment. The concept of doors and walls and garden fences and being on a lead are things that are not, they don't come naturally to dogs. Dogs have to learn to cope with those and to habituate to them. And if they don't habituate to them, then sensitization happens and all sorts of fears and anxieties, those types of behaviors can occur. And that's where I come in, when it's a dog that is not coping with the life it's being expected to lead. Whereas in Turkey, I see dogs, you know, they'll hang out in the village square near the tea garden. One dog might be lying down in a really nice patch of sunlight. Another dog will come up. You won't see any overt communication that you could observe between those two dogs. But either the approaching dog will walk up and then just walk away again because it's not your time to have that patch of sunlight, or the dog that's lying down might have had their fill of that motivated behavior of lying down and catching rays and getting warm. And so that dog might be the one then to get up and move away, and you will see the dog that approached settling themselves down and lying down in that exact same spot. And I don't see resource holding contests in dogs, I guess, because there are sufficient resources, and part of that does go back to the fact that they are fed extra food by the humans in the community when required.
I was quite surprised at the first trap, neuter, vaccinate, release camp that I went to in Nepal, in that they go out, collect all the dogs from the area, put them all into one truck and take them to the center. And I must have stood there with just an incredulous look on my face, because how can you take all these dogs and just throw them into one pickup and they're not going to fight? They don't. They're so used to understanding each other that you can take unrelated dogs from different areas and bring them into a smaller space. And there is no... It blew my mind. If we tried to do that here, we would have a major dogfight.
We would. And I think, and part of that, I think, is to do with epigenetically the breeding that's gone down through so many generations now of the resilient free living dogs, where being chucked in the back of a truck is something that's manageable for them mentally. Whereas example behavior cases that I might have in the UK would be a dog that just jumps out of their skin when a leaf blows in the wrong direction or something outside makes the wrong kind of noise. They're so sensitized to their environment and what goes on in it.
And I think that's one thing that really came out of our paper, was this conclusion that feral is largely defined as escape from human control, and whether that's sort of our idea of for example, what a dog is. So a dog running loose in the UK would be termed feral, because that's not how dogs are supposed to behave. We have this idea of how animals should behave, where they should be, and when they kind of defy that, that's when the feral label comes in. And I found it kind of interesting in some of my responses too, there was sort of this element of trying to re-embrace feral as a positive thing. And also the joking too, like saying my neighbor's kids, sort of what does feral mean to you? And they're like, oh, the neighbor's kids or my kids. And it's basically just this idea that, in this case, children that are running free, doing their own thing, making noise, playing in dirt like kids do, that's deemed by some as feral because they're not being proper and civilized. And that did come up. That was a definition that came up a lot, was this association of feral as being uncivilized. But then this idea of civilized is cultural and yeah, it just comes. And I love the term community cats. I try and sort of use that rather than feral or street cats, because it implies that they're part of the community, and I think it sort of fosters this idea, like with the community dogs you were talking about, that they're part of the community and people care for them, and they're meant to be there, so they're not feral.
Right.
Yes, they're valued. They have value for that community. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's interesting too. I want to kind of go down the horse path for a minute, because when we think about feral cat versus community cat, right? Feral is it's a scary term. It's a cat that is out of our control, whereas community cat is a welcome cat. And we see this with the cat horse comparison too, because, you know, a feral cat is kind of a nuisance, whereas a feral horse is a beautiful creature that we plan vacations to go visit here in the US and, you know, go see the feral horses, but that's not what the ad says. You know, the ad says go see the wild horses. I was hoping Debbie, you could touch on that a little bit about this whole, when does being feral become being wild, or is wild just another term that we use to kind of control that narrative between a horse that's under human control and a horse that has gone off on its own?
Yeah, and I think genetically, the kind of prevailing discourse is that there is no horse now that you could describe as wild. All those subspecies have become extinct, and even the Zavalsky horse, which was thought until quite recently to be the one wild subspecies left, is now thought to have had domesticated ferus equus caballus genes for many, many generations. I was thinking in terms of how wild is used in the States and in Australia as well, because as well as it being the beautiful symbol of how the West was won, there is also now the encroachment of wild or feral horses, free roaming horses, onto areas of land where they are not welcome. And it might be that they're not welcome because there is interspecies competition for resources, in terms of that the human occupiers want to utilize that land and the horses are getting in the way, or also I think in terms of the Australian situation, there is a discourse of what are the native species and what aren't the native species, and the Brumbies are deemed to be not a native species because of the way that they arrived in Australia and then became free living, because they escaped. Did they escape domestication, or did they escape the kept captive managed status? So they too are persecuted, if you want to use that term. And although obviously there are people who think that culling the numbers is justified, but the fact is that they are not always. So there's a kind of a dichotomy there, and a tension between how they might be viewed as beautiful wild beasts, and that's usually the the language that's used is if they're beautiful and awe-inspiring, then they are wild. What does that mean in terms of the meaning that we're making out of that socially and culturally? Or if they are the ones that are not welcome for whatever reason, then the terminology changes to, oh, well, they're feral, they're worthless, they don't mean anything, they have no value. So, and the human perspective is privileged, and so then those animals are culled, or if not culled, then relocated, rounded up and relocated. A lot of them are taken in and then trained, so they do become kept animals. What does that mean for their mental and emotional states and health? That they were born, their ancestors for so many generations were born free living, and now they are taken into a completely different paradigm of control, where the control is taken away from them, choice and agency is taken away from them, and the control then lies in the human side of the relationship.
And I think we have to weigh that use of feral as well, because here wild means, oh yes, they're welcome, come in, and feral essentially means killable or removable, right? And I think Chris has run into that too with the cat situation. We've all seen that with the cat situation in Australia, that if you deem something feral, that means that you are allowed to practice control over that, and it makes them killable.
Mm. And the thing is, it really seems to be working on cat people too. So I'm going to read this quote out from my data set. And it's part of a conversation about conservationist proposals to cull feral cats. And it really illustrates how this word feral acts as a form of othering. So, yeah, it reads, "Calm down, folks. There's a big difference between little fluffy you adore and a feral cat population. For starts, feral cats are not pets, they're wild animals." So that is like really full of contradiction. First, they're calling them wild animals, but in the same discourse, wild animals are good, whereas feral animals are bad. But the real thing that struck me is how, the only thing that differentiates Fluffy from a feral cat is their circumstances of birth. They're both the same species. But calling one feral allows people who are emotionally attached to their companion cat to say, okay, that's not like Fluffy. That's a horrible feral creature. And I think that's really the power of feral to really other species like cats who are loved. And yeah, this was responding to an article. It wasn't just talking about killing feral cats, there was also pigs and I think another species in there that was totally ignored by the comments. It was all the cats. Focus was on the cats being culled.
That's what came home to me when you were reading that, was the linguistic power of the two different words and what they mean, and what they mean ultimately to the lives or the deaths of those species.
Well, this is probably a good place to refer back to your comments about domestication, Debbie, because we have written a paper about domestication as well, and we'll put that in the comments section. But it does come down to the two different definitions of domestication. And one is, the actual biological definition of domestication, of having been brought in to human control and having humans controlling your breeding and having, human control over your whole life, as opposed to what seems to be the more common sort of non-academic definition of domesticated as anything that you've brought into your your home, right? And so people sort of use that word to determine if something is truly feral or something is not feral. And yeah, it's another problematic element.
Yes, it is. Yeah, the meanings. So, you know, again, one word, so many different meanings depending on context and depending on, and I think that also brings in an element of when and why certain groups of people choose to use the same word in different with different meanings or the different words, feral versus wild or domesticated, but using that in to mean different things in different contexts.
Very much so. Let's follow through that domestication thought process to the elephants that I work with in Nepal, because elephants have clearly not been domesticated. They don't meet the requirements for biological domestication, right? Humans have never had control over their breeding. They're a large charismatic animal that takes a long time to reproduce, which means that they don't really have those pre-domestication, pre-adaptation characteristics that Price talks about. And yet, if you look at a lot of documentation, authorities will refer to them as domesticated elephants. And a lot of countries have domesticated elephant management policies. And I think that that's another way to use this language as control, because once something is called domesticated for long enough, it has that implication of us being able to treat it however we want. But when an elephant escapes human control, we don't use the word feral. We use the word rogue.
Yes.
Which has the same connotations, maybe escapes human control, not behaving as they should.
Right. And so
that's the commonality, isn't it? That the, you know, they're controlled or they're not controlled. And controlled is good, out of control, out of human control, and the preferential status of the human, out of that control, feral, not good, not wanted, not helpful, not useful to us.
Yes, and I find it interesting too, just because rogue, when you think of that word, you think about like the lovable rogue, like, I don't know, Jack Sparrow from the, you know, and then we have the actual rogue, which indicates, you know, out of societal control as well, you know, acting against societal norms and creating discussion or destruction and breaking the law. And, you know, so it's again, yes, it's all these labels, when in reality, the elephant is simply returning to the wild. You know, we've taken away its ability to survive well in the wild because, you know, elephants eat 100 different plants in the wild, and in captivity, they may have, you know, 10. So when they do return into the wild, as it were, you know, they aren't clear. They haven't had that social learning of what to eat. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, a lot of that responsible for the elephants going rogue is that they just don't have the ability to deal with the situation. Like you were saying, with dogs that have lived with humans too long, they no longer have that capacity to sort of deal with the stress and end up just sort of running around looking for help, you know?
It's interesting, that idea of lovable rogue, because some people see feral cats or free living cats in that way, and sort of feral to them, they're like, oh, I love feral cats, or I love seeing the cats in the neighborhood. They're my friends, and they're and almost this kind of affinity, so that they feel sort of connected to these cats that are living independently, but then on the other side of that, it is this idea of feral as it being in need. So the idea that feral cats in particular need rescuing, and that a cat that's out on the streets is inherently unloved and needs loving and needs to be brought in and kept by the fireplace. And for many cats, that's not what they want, especially if they've never really had much contact with humans. That's the taking them into an animal shelter is like, as you mentioned, Debbie, with the dogs, would be horrendous for them to be sort of forced into that human environment. But yeah, this feral label also, it's connected with these ideas of stray and abandoned, which is totally different. A cat that's been abandoned, that's always lived in a house and suddenly thrown out on the streets. Yeah, they need help there. But yeah, it's this feral label is taken and used in so many different ways. And usually it is negative. It's and especially regarding conservationist jargon, it can be a definition that allows them to be culled.
Yes. And what you were saying there, Chris, was just about it brought to mind to me this idea of them just, you know, not being able to look after themselves, when actually the free living feral ones can look after themselves and have looked after themselves. And there's no cognizance given to that, no recognition or differentiation between the ones that have been abandoned and do need support. Doesn't necessarily mean that they need taking into another household, although, you know, perhaps they do if that's where they've come from. But the ones who are agentically making decisions about their own survival, making choices about how they live their life and living a very fruitful life from the perspective of that species, but that's not the same as the perspective of the human. I think that's where a lot of the tensions lie.
Yeah. So it's also control too. I mean, even control by love. You want to to protect them and look after them because you see them as needing help. So it's another form of human control that's well intended, maybe in the case of free living cats, but not necessarily. Not everything needs to be controlled by humans.
Well, I think that's a term, stray versus feral too. Feral represents to us something that has escaped and deserves to be out there, whereas stray indicates something that has wandered away accidentally and is in need of our help. I wonder too if it has anything to do with what these animals eat that relates to their acceptability as feral versus wild. Because if you have wild horses that wander onto your property, and you're sitting out there in awe of these wild horses who might be eating grass, it's a little different than when you've got cats bringing dead birds onto your patio and you are accusing the cats of killing off, you know, native species, which they occasionally do, right? So do you think that has anything to do with it, that we accept this herbivorous, non-threatening creature more than we do this carnivorous creature?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, a horse, I suppose, you know, your lawn would quickly disappear as well if a free living horse decided to pitch up and eat your grass. But I definitely do think that there is some, it's almost a kind of interspecies resource holding tension there. If you think of, I'm thinking of also, you know, dogs who raid dustbins, free living dogs who might raid a dustbin or, annoy the tourists by sitting begging at tables. There is definitely, I think, something in the different food that they eat and also the different ways that they have learned, either they've learned it, they've learned a behaviour that enables them to acquire food, or they have a naturally occurring behavior that enables them to acquire food. And when that comes into conflict with how humans would want to control their environment, I suppose, in terms of manicure their gardens or other ways that animals might encroach in a food gathering kind of way, that again another source of conflict and tension.
And I wondered about that, because here in Florida we've got the rhesus macaque monkeys that are referred to as free ranging rather than feral. When they do, obviously, if they're kept in, you know, laboratory settings, definitely rhesus macaques can qualify as a domesticated species. And here in Florida, what happened is that some of the little tour boat captains decided that purchasing macaques and letting them go on islands would be a fun way to have tourists interact with the wild by throwing them fruit. You know, they're also plant eaters. And what happened instead is that the monkeys would come and jump on the boats and steal people's belongings, looking for this food that they'd been promised. So what happened is a lot of them were relocated to islands where they would be safe. No one bothered to do the research that they can swim. And they swam off the island and expanded through Florida. And I wonder if part of the reason that they were allowed to expand for so long was just that they are, you know, plant eaters. They weren't breaking onto people's property and killing their livestock. But it is interesting to me that these are you never see write-ups about feral monkeys in Florida. You just read about free ranging or wild. They call them wild monkeys. Introduced, you know, this, there's never this feral conversation because I think they were seen as sort of mutually beneficial in the beginning, that, you know, they would provide interest for tourists and bring more tourists, and they didn't, you know, destroy the native wildlife, because people think of native wildlife as animals, not plants.
So some sort of symbiosis there, and the different way of describing them because of the lack of conflict with the human community.
Yeah, so they were left alone just for years here in Florida, and they expanded, which was great. And they hadn't been any coals for years, and then all of a sudden they started to carry a virus that's contagious to humans. And so now suddenly, you know, this conversation has restarted. So that the occasional damage to human through bites or, you know, theft was a kind of overlooked. It was accepted. But now that they pose a threat to people in the U.S., now there's this different discussion. You know, the conversation has changed from their acute little free-ranging, you know, introduced species to now being a problem, you know, a pest species.
I mean, that's interesting in terms of the UK at the moment. We've got avian flu, and I'm not sure. I mean, certainly the egg-laying chickens are all, by law at the moment, required to be housed inside to try to prevent the spread of that. But not totally sure about my grounds in stating this, but there are some conversations about what might that mean if that spreads to the wild bird population. There we go again, they're described as wild. And then what that might mean in terms of and any change in the way that they are viewed, and actually thinking further about that, certainly in the UK, we have bird species such as pigeons that are commonly referred to as pests. So yeah, there's that aspect as well.
Which is interesting because pigeons were one of the earliest domesticated species. Yeah. So we've got this longer term relationship with the species, and now that has completely flipped on its head and become that they're, you know, a pest species. So
they stopped being useful to us, and now we might perceive them as actually harmful.
And I wonder too if it would be a difference because, you know, from an American, you know, like you said, how the West was one mentality. I think that ferality has a positive feeling. Look, oh, this is a feral animal that we're going to support because it's, you know, it's tough and it survived on its own. I wondered if we started applying feral to pigeons, would there be this change of perspective? You know, would people start talking about those feral pigeons that have made a life for themselves? They're so brave and.
Yes, we kind of you know, to from a species perspective, dependent on humans in terms of initial domestication. But like you say, now they've kind of broken free of that domestication chain or fence or boundary, and live their lives differently. And what does that mean to us? And what indeed does it mean to them?
And why is it we're not concerned with protecting, you know, these populations as opposed to protecting, you know, free living dogs or, you know.
Yeah, going back to the power of feral. So one thing I've written about is the idea of a moral panic over roaming cats and other animals that have been subject to moral panics also include free roaming dogs. Often when, somebody has been attacked or bitten by a dog, and then, so basically a moral panic is something that's, it's something that's real and something that may well be a real concern, but it's sort of blown out of proportion by the media, and this kind of folk devil is created. And for cats, feral really acts as othering, as I already mentioned. So you've got this feral who's different from domesticated cats, so you can have the same discourse. And I call it the feral folk devil in the case of cats. I can put the reference in the thing, but there's a couple examples with dogs where the dogs have been portrayed as a folk devil, the individual that's to be feared, the wild, the feral dogs that are going around biting people and endangering lives, and have been behind a couple of culls. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. The other framing of the folk devil is it's the human's fault. So the humans are blamed for allowing their dogs to escape and run wild. So the folk devil then becomes irresponsible owners. And I see that too with cats, as either the cats themselves being framed as the bird killing folk devils. And then there's the irresponsible owners who let the cats poop on people's lawns. So
they've got any control over that whatsoever.
So it all goes down to sort of, this idea of control and anything that is out of, what is proper is.
Well, I think that's why these discussions of language are so interesting, because, you don't speak language to yourself in solitude, right? It requires a participation. It requires a listener and a user of the language. And so by nature, that makes it sort of flexible and changeable. And it also, so reliant on the environment in which you find yourself. If I'm standing on the street and cats are crowding around me and scratching my feet, clearly I'm going to use the term differently than I would if I have this cute little kitten in my backyard who, it's very dependent upon the listener. It's dependent upon the user of the word, and it's very dependent upon the situation. So there's really no way to change what these terms mean unless we start using them in different ways. As researchers, as scientists, start applying them in more specific ways to stop their misuse.
Yes. And, I wonder if we can ever do that, especially in the age of the internet, where there are so many more papers published and so many more groups of people referring to scientific publications, but referring to them in a kind of popular way, in terms of holding up one paper and going, hey, somebody's written this and it must be true and it proves my point, instead of understanding how a body of knowledge is built up over time and quantity of research and publications. So I almost, certainly behaviourally, I see that as a kind of Pandora's box, where previously we, as scientists, we were able to keep a tighter hold on some of these definitions, but that now they're out there in the land of social media, being made meaning of and altered sometimes inside, you know, with our awareness, sometimes outside our awareness, and what that will mean going forward for society in terms of those definitions and that language.
I think one positive example comes from sort of feminist scholars in the 60s with this big push away from using he as a generic, so rather than mankind or gone where no man has gone before, it sort of changed to humankind, and replacing the generic he with either he, she, or there to and yeah, that's sort of been a big change. And I was reading, it was a paper done in Australia where they looked at keynote speakers and how they were using this language now, and whether they were using male specific or sort of the more politically correct progressive language. And it sort of shifted, I think. And yeah, they also looked at guests on radio shows, and like the shift from recordings in the 50s to the, I think it was early 2000s, the study was published, and sort of there's a shift from almost entirely being the language of the patriarchy to like 90%+ using person instead of man, and saying she or they rather than just he for a generic generic person. And interestingly, there was like the 5-10%, they were all sort of senior male academics who were still using them. Yeah. So yeah, and I think that's just sort of common language now. I think that and that's a positive thing, because it's very subconscious, but yeah, so the idea that you can have it's not a policeman, it's not a male job. And yeah, I think there's real potential for sort of changing cultural perceptions through language, though with the internet and social media now, it's a whole other ball game, right?
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it makes me think of the thing that I mentioned at the start, which was about this concept of the kept animal. As soon as I read that, being the age I am, I went straight back to the concept of a kept woman. Yes. Again, the idea that this person couldn't think for themselves, needed a degree of protection and control. So it's going to be, it's interesting to me to see, to look at how this term kept, as in a kept animal, do the same kind of meanings attract to that in terms of the animal? Are we talking about animals who need protection and control, possibly perceptually, socio-culturally at the moment? We are, but how might that change? And why has that word been introduced alongside terms like pet, domesticated, companion, farm, feral?
Well, I think it's because captive has so many connotations as well. And I use when I refer in my papers, I use the term captive elephant as opposed to, depending on the situation, sometimes I use working elephant, just because I don't think that, you know, domestication doesn't fit. It is a wild animal who has been brought into human control. And that's why I do use the term captive. You know, it's a very telling word. But I think that if we start thinking of our own companion animals as captive animals, because there are a lot of them that would prefer not to be living in homes, right? And I think that that's a term that's fraught with guilt, you know, for their human captors, as it were. And so I wonder if that isn't why this kept seems to be a sort of a kinder, gentler word that it indicates you're giving something back as well, that it's a mutual relationship. And so I wonder, as we progress in realizing the needs and desires and agency of our companion animals, will we find, you know, new terms that better describe an equal relationship? Because kept is still not equal. We really need to find that kind of equal word that indicates that they're family members, they're kin, instead of simply kept.
Yes. And then when if that arises, how will that affect how we, I'm going to use the word keep them, in terms of what do we allow them to, what do we try and stop them doing, prevent them from doing, what do we allow them to do, what control do we exert over them? And going back to the kind of rejection of the term captive, I find that really interesting, because yes, we don't like to use that word, but in my behavior work with dogs and horses, the thing that helps them the most is enabling them to express their species specific qualities and behaviors, that the very behaviors that are innate to their telos, their speciesness of the horseness of a horse, the dogness of a dog, which all goes back to pre-domestication, at whatever the level of captiveness or of how we keep them now, that's what it goes back to.
So in a way, going feral is a positive thing, right? If going feral, it's returning to that state. And maybe I was also thinking with the language thing too. So the suffragettes, you could almost say that they were feral women, right? They escaped the patriarchy and they reclaimed their place in society. Yes. So we kind of, feral is used a lot to kind of degrade other, well, humans and other animals, but maybe we should reframe it as a positive thing.
So we're seeing a real sort of feminist intersection and perspective there, aren't we, emerging
very much, that reclamation of agency.
Yeah
I think that's very important.
Yes, I think so.
All right. Well, that sounds like an excellent place to end our conversation today. And we look forward to talking with you again on the Anthrozoology podcast. Thanks for listening.